You're listening to Women Making Waves.
We have put together a programme which celebrates women.
We find women who are striking out on their own and achieving some extraordinary results. I'm Linda Ness.
And I'm Susie Thorpe, and we produce and present Women Making Waves.
In this edition of Women Making Waves, we speak to two incredible women. Hannah Deacon has featured in the media because she fought to allow her son to be given medical cannabis, which has brought his severe epilepsy under control. Mother of two, Hannah tells her story of frustration and success, which involves the most powerful people in the country.
Sheila Kassan Marshall has degrees in aeronautical, mechanical and civil engineering and over 20 years in construction. And Sheila can safely say she likes, in fact, she loves building bridges, highways, runways, tunnels and buildings like the Shard. Then came breast cancer and another road to build. That's all coming up on this episode of Women Making Waves.
You're listening to Women Making Waves.
Sheila Kassan Marshall's journey to board level, especially as a woman in the civil engineering industry, has faced obstacles at all levels. Then came another blockade, breast cancer. Sheila's plight to improve not only her life after treatment, but that of other women too, is impressive. Sheila talks to Susie Thorpe.
Mental determination that day by day in my head, almost brick by brick, piece of concrete by piece of concrete in my mind, I was a bridge that needed rebuilding and re-strengthening mentally and physically. I'm not a survivor. I'm so much more than that. I have fought for my life. Rocked up at school and said, I want to do my work experience on the Channel Tunnel. They said, absolutely not. This was a school run by Irish Catholic nuns. Because when she started texting me and I could hardly walk and everything was still bleeding, I would text her back, are you mad? I've been through breast cancer, leave me alone. I do feel if somebody gave me a box of drawings and said, can you go and build that bridge or can you rebuild my runway, it would be sure.
Welcome to Women Making Waves, Sheila Kassan Marshall. Nice to have you here, Sheila.
Thank you.
Now, I've got to say, you're an incredibly talented person, aeronautical, mechanical and civil engineering you have as degrees. You have managed significant infrastructure delivery for BAA, Dublin Airport Authority and the developers of Shard as well. Now, you've also built runways and bridges and Westminster Station, Jubilee Line Extension and rebuilding the M25 and the M11. Well, you've been in the construction sector for 20 years and now you are advisor to, well, you work at the Judge Business School.
Yes, I'm a coach at the business school on their accelerator entrepreneurial programme, which is an absolute privilege and an honour. And I'm particularly interested in helping with some of the management techniques they need to adopt and as they're growing their teams. Obviously, in my experience in construction, having a high performing team means everything. And that's connectivity to your people and passion to work with people is how you deliver these big jobs. So that's hopefully what I bring to my coaching.
But you've also very recently started up the website called Bosom Buddies. Why had you conceived this idea?
I started Bosom Buddies after my own experience with a cancer journey. My children were 1.5 and 2.5. Fortunately for me, looking back, I booked myself into a health check because it had been 5 years since I'd had one with work. And much to my shock and horror, they found that I had breast cancer. I then had a year's worth of intensive breast cancer treatment, chemotherapy, had surgery afterwards and then on to radiotherapy. Through that process, I, like most people, went home on the first night and Googled breast cancer and it scared the bejesus out of me. It was a terrifying experience. When I next saw the consultant, I sort of said, well, you know, I've had a Google, and he said, please don't feel the need to do that again. Just stay away from the internet, put your trust in me and we will guide you through and you don't need to know anything apart from we know what we're doing. And that's exactly what I did. I sort of shut down that world and just went on a journey with my oncologist doctor and the breast surgeon and met them regularly. And thank goodness I had a very good physiological response to the treatment. And although it was horrific and painful, and I think the side effects are far greater than anyone particularly talks about, I think there's a bit of this strange thing that you're going through breast cancer and people think it's not pleasant, but it's OK. And it's worse than that, I think. It's really tough. Mm. At the end of it, I decided that having survived it, I wanted to be as mentally and physically strong and able as I possibly could be. And I was coming from a very weak place. So I started a 12-week mindfulness course, which was run through the Cambridge Cancer Centre. It was a free programme that was offered and it was absolutely inspiring and life-changing for me. I then also decided that I would put one foot quite physically in front of the other and start to build up walking to start with and just stretching my arms up the wall, even though it was painful, to rebuild my strength. And I had a mental determination that day by day in my head, almost brick by brick, piece of concrete by piece of concrete in my mind, I was a bridge that needed rebuilding and re-strengthening mentally and physically. And so I set about this journey. And after 14 weeks, I was mentally strong and in a great place and felt in control of what had happened, as opposed to, you know, having a mental breakdown, which can happen a lot after such a traumatic experience.
And quite understandably too.
Because it's only after you finish your active treatment that you sort of fall off the end of the conveyor belt in terms of the doctors. They don't see you anymore because you are effectively better. And your friends and family back off a bit because you're, you know, deemed to be a bit better. And your brain starts to process all of this journey you've been on. And also from a physical point of view, I just wanted to regain that control of my life. And I also knew that from a longevity point of view, you have a far greater, your longevity is improved by being actively fit and healthy. There is research to show that. So over 12 to 14 weeks, I went from being hardly able to cross my own kitchen floor to running 5K three times a week and three HIIT workouts. And in fact, I did a reference for the personal trainer who helped me through that process. Mm. Because when she started texting me and I could hardly walk and everything was still bleeding, I would text her back, "Are you mad? I've been through breast cancer. Leave me alone. Why do you keep telling me to go to a gym? I can't walk." And she kept, you know, this persistence up, saying, "Just come in." And I'd say, "Well, I'm coming in a dress because I'm not exercising. You must be crazy. Why do you keep..." And she put me through a fitness assessment, and then and somehow she put me on a tread machine and she would talk to me, or she'd put me on the cycle machine or whatever it was, or give me some light weights. And I would sort of be scowling at this poor woman as she was trying to rehabilitate me. And somewhere she worked her magic over sort of 14 weeks and I was running 5K. It's incredible.
Wow. And now you thank her very much.
Oh, I do. Yes. I absolutely do. I really do.
So were you trying to change, Sheila? Were you trying to change the narrative of post-cancer treatment? Is that something that you found that there was nothing out there?
Absolutely. When I approached the physiotherapy department attached to Adam Brooks, through no fault of their own, I mean, there's a lot of us out there. We fill the place and people can't get much attention in terms of personal physiotherapy or understanding what one should be doing to strengthen and improve. And so I asked them, could they work with me to set up a programme? And they just didn't have the capacity to be able to help. Fortunately, the Nuffield, because they're private, were able to offer that help. So the programme that we've designed for 12 people at a time to go through is to enable people to have the same care I had with a cancer-trained specialist over 12 weeks, but it'll be a programme of 10 people at a time, which is how we can afford to do it. It's £2 a head a week, which is, I think, you know, at less than a cup of coffee, it's a good deal. And it gives people that quick start back into healthy living, healthy lifestyle, being fit and active and not being scared that you're going to physically pull something. You're scared that you will or hurt it or do something or make it come back. And I think this alleviates all of those fears.
And also you were saying that the media give a very pessimistic approach to post-treatment for cancer. And you couldn't find anywhere on the website that was giving you a more positive, a way forward.
Yes, absolutely. And in looking myself a bit of understanding about breast cancer, or if you see something in the media have picked up a lot on, you know, I can hardly bring myself to say it, but those, you know, our friends, fellows that haven't made it through the journey. And it's really traumatic having been through breast cancer to only hear these stories, because you're actually looking for some inspiration for somebody who's got through it and they're thriving. And there's a term, you're a breast cancer survivor. Well, I don't like that term. I'm not a survivor. I'm so much more than that. I have fought for my life and I'm thriving. And every day I live my life as well as I possibly can. And I'm here, I'm larger than life, I'm big and I'm bold. It feels like a weakness that I don't associate with myself or all my cohorts that have been through this journey.
I suppose in many ways, were you frightened or were you sort of realising that people boxed you in a certain corner?
Absolutely. And I think it's slightly like as if you're a sort of victim. And I can't imagine in any way feeling like a victim. It's not in my nature. And even going through breast cancer, I probably at times did play down how difficult it was, because I didn't want to be a victim. I wanted to be as big and bold as I always had been. And so that was my, I suppose, defence mechanism to get through it. That when I went to see the consultants, they said, "How are you?" I'd say, "I'm fantastic. I'm great. You know, give me more of this pain."
And I bet they looked at you quite shocked.
The ladies that joined me straight after my treatment, they came off the back of the mindfulness programme, and so we had a natural cohort. And I think the way the walks and the exercise programmes will work is that first year when you're going through your rehabilitation back into your working life, it's a great time to meet other people. You might still have surgery needs, and you can. We all talk about that very openly, about what we've had, and somebody has always got a breast hanging out to show somebody else what a mastectomy looks like.
You've hardly got any scars. You've had an incredible operation in the sense that it's been a positive operation.
Yeah.
Now, there are times where women don't have such a positive time with mastectomy, but it's getting better.
It's very varied. That there is far greater understanding now, and through the NHS, of giving women the choice to have reconstruction surgery. And I think it's horses for courses. I think depending on your age would be how much you would feel that you would identify with needing some sort of reconstruction. I personally know ladies in their 80s who didn't have reconstruction, and that is totally understandable. And I think at that age, neither would I. As a young-ish woman in my early 40s...
Oh, go on, you're youngish, don't be silly.
With two young children... It's a fantastic thing to be able to wear. I used to have on the front of my phone, I've just taken it off recently, but I have a picture of myself in my bikini a few months after surgery on the beach with my children. And I look beach ready, better than I ever have in my life, because the fat was removed from my stomach. As the procedures, they prefer to use your own body fat because the body accepts it better. And it was grafted into the breast. And the result is a very natural looking full breast. And it looks fantastic. I post children, and having gained and lost a bit of weight, my breasts certainly didn't look that good before. So I'm being very lucky. I'm delighted with my outcome. I have been very lucky. And I also say to the women I meet, if you're not happy, there is things that they can do. They can use fillets in the way one would have a breast implant. There are many different techniques, and there are things that surgically that can make us look better. And I think having body confidence to be able to go out on a beach or wear a dress at night to a party, whatever it is, but I think we should own that and we have a right to that. And I think in this climate, even the NHS have recognised it's an important part of our mental well-being, and I really think it is. So I definitely fully support that, and I have been to meetings with people who have gone back to their GPs to say, "I'm not really happy with the outcome of this." And I believe that you should keep going back until you are happy. This isn't a mental health issue, that it's some body confidence thing. I'm delighted that there's been more money now going into the reconstruction side of breast cancer, and an acknowledgement that we need to own and feel happy with our bodies.
Okay. Now, in October, you were a guest speaker at the Cambridge Launchpad at STEM, that was the Bradfield Centre, and one of the reviewers described your speech as rousing. Okay, now that's fantastic. Sharing your incredible journey through your career as a woman in civil engineering and keen to inspire girls to pursue their dream careers without fear and encourage their thirst. I love that word, thirst, for knowledge. And now, this is really poignant. This is the bit I really found quite interesting. Your obstacles that you faced from your family, friends, schools and colleagues. And this is from a career point of view. Yeah. Now, you began with saying that your father wasn't happy about you going into civil engineering or engineering.
Engineering generally, particularly anything to do with construction. My father was a Kerry farmer. And when he moved to the UK, he worked on the Channel Tunnel. I was 14 when the boring machine arrived onto the South Downs as part of the start of the Channel Tunnel. And this is the era when Maggie Thatcher was on the news every night. And whether you liked it or not, it was a big piece of news. And I wanted it. I decided that I would be one of those men, because they were all men, who were going to build this tunnel to France. So that was my dream. When I rocked up at school and said, I want to do my work experience on the Channel Tunnel, they said, absolutely not. This was a school run by Irish Catholic nuns. And they said, we've already booked your work experience at Carmichael's Bakery, and that's where you're going. So we were very far apart as to my vision and theirs. And from my father's point of view, 30 odd years ago, the construction industry was an incredibly rough place for a girl. I mean, it was there weren't many women engineers. There were very few and far between. It was quite an abusive environment. So I can complete and filthy, you know, and I can completely understand why he was against it. I was headstrong, and I left home at 16 and enrolled on a college course to do civil engineering, and then from there got my degree. When I graduated, he was so proud and happy and delighted.
You're also a capital investment director, responsible for £100 million worth of portfolio of infrastructure projects as part of a wider £2 billion upgrade project as well. So you have an enormous amount of experience, Sheila. You also said, because of this Bosom Buddy website, that you are taking a break from it because it's probably a natural break, that you feel... What made you make that decision?
After a year of, almost a year now, of doing Bosom Buddies, my intention had been, and in my head, I thought it would be quite easy to go national, that there would be supported Bosom Buddy walks in all the major towns. I thought that the rehabilitation programme would go national. Wherever there's the NHS cancer centres, they would have this rehabilitation programme. The reality is, even being supported through taking desk space at Allianz, they have been fantastic. As a one person on a startup, it's incredibly difficult. If the IT goes kaput, it's only me who has to somehow try and do it. I'm not an IT expert, far from it. And I found working on the back office IT incredibly difficult. Even uploading stuff onto my website and changing the website, I found incredibly difficult because it's not my area. I'm an engineer. And so I found that you, as a startup, you're kind of on your own in the world. And having spent a 20 odd year career with knocking elbows with people on big projects and working with hundreds and sometimes thousands of people, it's really, really tough. It's far tougher than I'd ever envisaged. And I don't feel I've got the skill set. I do feel if somebody gave me a box of drawings and said, can you go and build that bridge or can you rebuild my runway, it would be sure. That's easy, you know. So sometimes I think there's a bit of horses for courses, and I am now applying to go back into the workplace as a civil engineer.
As much as we don't want to have breast cancer, we don't want any cancer, it does change you.
It does. And I think it's both positive and negative. The positive side is you don't sweat the small stuff. You can't, because life has a much higher clarity in many ways. I honestly, and I know this sounds hippie, I'm not a hippie, but I feel
you don't look a hippie.
I feel that the colours are brighter, they're sharper, my definition in the world feels stronger. I feel mentally and physically attuned to things in a way, in a depth that I hadn't seen before. I feel that I see things clearer. So I'm sure that's not the chemotherapy drugs they've put through me, but I do feel that I understand the world in a greater way. I feel a level of emotional intelligence greater than I've ever had. I can't walk by something. I could probably, to a tiny extent, walk by before, but I certainly can't now. If I see something and somebody in distress, I have to get involved. And after something like a breast cancer journey, I think you say, I don't need to be doing that, so I'm going to stop that and do what makes me happy and makes the people around me happy. I think the negative side is a little bit of a strange loop that tells me I might not be here forever. And as much as I want to live as well as I possibly can to be here for my children, I haven't got that guarantee. I know none of us have, but I think unless you've been through a life-changing journey, you sort of assume you will be. And I don't have that safety blanket anymore. So it's made me want to live a bit quicker, and sometimes quicker than I should. I'm in a rush to do everything because I want to tell my children 1,000,000,000 times how much I love them, and I want to get that job that I've always aspired to, and I want to help my friend that I should have always done things for, whatever it is.
If you had three adjectives to describe you post what you've just been through and what you have done, what you've achieved, and before that, you're in trying to inspire girls, you want them to have a thirst, boys and girls, to get into STEM,
yes,
STEM
absolutely.
Subjects, and you've been in construction for 20 years. How would you describe yourself now?
Brave and bold.
I love that.
And strong would be the words I would have used to describe myself. I think it takes a while to come back to that place, but I would certainly aspire to be brave, bold and strong. My 4-year-old daughter says whenever she's asked to do something she doesn't like, or as her particular mantra in life is, I am big and I am strong and I am totally myself. And I think that's a good place to be in the world. So
I love it.
So probably a bit like her. My husband says, I don't know where she gets this from, Sheila.
I think building bridges and runways is far easier sometimes than building a website, is it not?
That's very true.
Thank you so much indeed.
Thank you.
Another absolutely amazing woman, Susie. Sheila's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, no, she was very, very inspiring, actually. And she comes from 20 years of construction experience. She's a civil engineer. She's done lots of talks. She's inspiring to young girls as well. She's really going out there and helping others. Not only that, she's gone through breast cancer as well, as we've just heard. And I think she's found that really traumatic and very hard. But, you know, it's the case, isn't it, with all people that we meet, that they go through something very traumatic and yet they come out of it and want to help other people.
Yeah.
And her PT trainer had decided that she's going to come in and get some help as well. I'm saying no to the PT trainer and saying, I'm in a dress. There's
that
no
was
way.
Funny.
Wasn't it?
That was very
wasn't
amusing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I loved the bit where she said that, you know, I'm not an IT person and I really couldn't cope with the IT. And I could, you know, it's this kind of thing that people don't think about. If you're doing a startup and you're working on your own as a kind of self person, just doing everything on your own as a solo worker, it's not easy. And you really do have to have a bit of a background where you have a lot of knowledge about a little bits and pieces of everything. Otherwise, your laptop packs in one day and you can't do anything.
Exactly.
Very, very difficult.
It is.
I love that honesty.
Yes, absolutely. Honesty is possible.
Very frank and a lovely interview.
Yeah, and I wish you all the best.
Me too.
You're listening to Women Making Waves.
Hannah Deacon hit the headlines because of her relentless campaign to legalise medicinal cannabis, driven by the fact that her son Alfie has a rare condition which escalated to cause up to 30 seizures a day. Now, rather than sitting back and accepting the treatment which was available, Hannah recognised that it was inadequate and even dangerous, and so has researched, travelled abroad and relentlessly campaigned to get the UK government to change their policy on the use of medical cannabis. Hannah Deacon speaks to Linda Ness.
I look back now and I think the warning signs were possibly there, but I was a first-time mum and I never listened to me. And I think that's a big lesson I've learned, is always listen to you when you're a mother. It was only about 4 months old that he became very unwell a lot. He had lots of illnesses, lots of viruses, lots of sickness bugs. So really nothing sort of highlighted it to me that there was anything other than he was just quite ill all the time. And then at 6 months old, he had a persistent cough, which never went away. And then at 8 months old, he had his first seizure.
And that must have been horrible, that first seizure. That must have been terrifying.
It was horrendous. Looking back now, he was starting the cluster during the day. He was having absences and we didn't realise that I put him outside in the garden. I remember 27th of May, 2012. Never forget that day. He was in the garden in a little travel cot with his toys and he suddenly just fell backwards. I just noticed it and thought, that's really strange. But again, if I'd have known the catastrophic thing that was going to happen that night, I'd have taken him straight to A&E, but I didn't. I just thought, oh, that's a bit strange. About midnight, I was woken by a scream, a very, very sort of rabid scream, and I ran to him and he was having a huge tonic-clonic seizure, the whole body shaking, throbbing at the mouth. He was 8 months old, obviously, so he's a tiny little baby. I picked him out. He was on fire. He was burning up. It was just the most frightening thing I've ever seen in my life. And we just put him in the car and took him straight to A&E. And within a couple of hours, it was very apparent that it wasn't a febrile seizure. He was very seriously ill. He was having 2 to 3 minute tonic-clonic seizures every 20 minutes to half an hour. And in the end, he was transferred to intensive care in Stoke. And we ended up in hospital for nearly 4 months. He was still seizing. They kept taking life support, on life support, off life support. He was just having seizures going in and out of children's ward into the intensive care unit. It was the most horrendous, frightening thing that I have ever experienced. They, at one point, had to put a central line in his neck while he was awake because they couldn't get lines into him. And I had to watch him. It goes against every part of your body as a mother to watch your baby go through what I've seen him go through. And I think that I will be traumatised for the rest of my life because of what I've seen my little boy go through.
Yeah.
I hope that he doesn't remember it. So in the end, I actually was following my gut and I just thought, this is wrong. This is just not happening. He'd been seizing at that point for over 2 weeks. I went to the boss of in the intensive care unit and I just said, you need to move us. You need to move us somewhere where there's a neurologist. In the end, we got transferred to Great Ormond Street Hospital. Great Ormond Street Hospital were amazing. They did every test again. What they felt was a massive immune response, which correlated with the fact that he'd been very unwell for months beforehand. Mm-hmm. So they said, we're going to give him intravenous steroids. And they took us into this room and they said, if it doesn't work, he probably will die. And that was just...
That's been so tough.
Oh, it was shocking. And the steroids did work, thank God. You know, they worked and they worked very quickly. And that's when they diagnosed him with immune responsive epilepsy. So we got transferred back to our local hospital and basically we just had to rehabilitate Alfie, you know, teach him all his skills again, wean him off all... He was on morphine, clonidine, loads of anti-epileptics. Obviously, none of it worked, so we had to wean him off all of that. Watching a 8-month-old baby go through cold turkey is pretty horrific. It was just, honestly, so harrowing, but actually only just the beginning. He basically had clusters then every 8 months. It was cyclical in nature. It was weird. It was like, you know, we weaned him off all the drugs. He remained on a low dose of anti-epileptic and a low dose of steroids under the advice of our neurologist, who was now at Birmingham Children's. We transferred back to Birmingham Children's. We did start to wean it, and then it happened again. And he said, the doctor said, oh, it's because you've weaned the drugs. But it was 8 months later, pretty much to the day. And then it happened every 8 months until he was 4. And then it started to happen every 3 weeks. And it just went bang every 3 weeks. And so we were in hospital once or twice a month. He was having up to 5 doses of intravenous steroids every time. He was having really aggressive clusters. And then when he was 5, he got diagnosed with a condition called PCDH19, which is a genetic disorder. We actually got a phone call on Christmas Eve when we knew he wouldn't be in hospital, so we were going to try and have a nice Christmas. And we got a phone call on Christmas Eve at 1:30 on Christmas Eve. I never forget it, from his neurologist saying, we found what's wrong with Alfie. Great Ormond Street have done this genetic test and he's got PCDH19. And he said, with age, we hope he'll get better. But other than that, there's no treatment for it. I still, to this day, do not know why we had a phone call on Christmas Eve. If he'd phoned me and said, there's a tablet and it will go away, then I'd have kissed him. But the fact is that he was telling me that my child would have to live like this forever. We were always told that if it was immune responsive epilepsy, it was likely he'd grow out of it. And Drew and I were obviously devastated, and we had to spend the whole of Christmas Day pretending we didn't know because we didn't want to upset our family. Mm-hmm. And then we told them on Boxing Day, and it was, again, another horrendously traumatic experience that could have been avoided by people thinking about how they might deal with things better. We, you know, carried on as we were, and then at five, when Alfie turned five, his seizures started to come every 4 to 7 days. So at that point, he was having up to 25 to 30 doses of steroids a month. And every time we took him into A&E, the doctors were like, this protocol of giving him intravenous steroids is highly dangerous. But they did it because that was the protocol from the doctor. It was the only thing that worked. He is steroid responsive. Absolutely nothing else will work with his seizures. So then I thought, well, why do steroids work? Well, what do? They work in two ways. They either suppress your immune system or they reduce the myelin inflammation in your brain. Every time Abby had a cluster, he was always trying to be ill. That's what I felt. He was always either trying to cough or trying to have a runny nose or trying to have a temperature every time. And obviously the presentation before he had his seizures, I was putting all that together in my head. I maybe wrongly, but as a mum, I was desperate. I thought, right, okay, we need to find something that is the same as steroids. We need to find something that isn't going to kill him, that will work. And I just started to do research, and I joined the PCDH19 support group, which is in America, where in 29 states, medical cannabis is available for use under prescription and sometimes without prescription in dispensaries and things. And I spoke to people and I just said, you know, do you use medical cannabis? And I met this one woman called Emily, whose daughter was the same as Alfie. They tried all the drugs, the ketogenic diet. We tried the ketogenic diet with Alfie. It didn't do anything. Her daughter had been seizure-free for nearly a year on medical cannabis, and they'd reduced all her drugs to a very small amount. And I just thought, that's what I want. And I learned about the endocannabinoid system. I learned about all the different sorts of cannabis. I just felt like I needed to do something, because I thought, if he dies, I will never forgive myself that I have not done something to try and fight for him. In the January 2017, I actually went on This Morning to talk about my desire to use cannabis with Alfie, and we got loads of really lovely comments, loads of support, and I thought, right, okay, I've got support here. You know, I'm not mad. I'm not doing the wrong thing. This is the right thing to do. So I set up a Facebook page called Alfie's Hope. I just decided to blog about what I wanted to do and let people see what it was like to be a parent of a child that was really ill, because I think it's a hidden thing. We do not talk about carers of children, parents who are carers. You know, when you have a baby, you know, for the first couple of years, 3-4 years, you know, it's going to be full on. But you know, when they start school, they're going to start being more independent, they're going to make friends. That doesn't happen when you have a child with a disability. It never stops being the baby years. And I just wanted to talk about that. And I just thought, well, how do I do it? I'll vlog. I like writing, but I'm not great at writing. So I thought, I'm good at talking. I'll do that. So I created the Facebook page. Then we went to see the neurologist at Birmingham Children's. I talked to him about medical cannabis. And he said to me, if you talk to me again about that, they'll report you to social services.
What?
Yeah. And I said, okay, I'm not telling you I'm going to grow a plant in my garage and give it to my child. I'm telling you, can we talk about this treatment for my son? He's in hospital every week with seizures. And that's what he said to me. He said to me there was a drug called Epidiolex coming out, made by a company called GW Pharmaceuticals, which was an isolated CBD-only drug, because, again, it has to be a single compound to do double-blind placebo trials on. So I said, OK, fine, can you apply to that for us on compassionate grounds? But they'd done a trial on two epilepsy conditions called Dravet and LGS, which is Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. So we got a response from GW Pharmaceuticals saying that Alfie didn't fit the criteria. And then we went to see our local paediatrician, who's absolutely amazing guy. I said to him, I can't work with this guy anymore at Birmingham Children's Hospital. He's just blocking everything I want to do. I can't talk to him. I don't feel cared for. I don't feel looked after. I don't feel my son is. I feel like we just go in every few months and he says, carry on as you are. And I said, he will die if we do this. And he said, yeah, I quite agree with you. It's not good enough. So he actually referred us to a different doctor at Oxford, John Radcliffe. who I am absolutely so grateful to, because he treated me like a human being, treated me like an equal. We had a long meeting in his room and he just said, if you carry on giving Alpha this amount of steroids or he has this amount of seizures, he will die or become psychotic. Because he said the long-term use of steroids will damage his brain so badly, he will have psychosis. So at that point, I plucked up the courage and I said, look, doctor, I have done loads of research into medical cannabis, full extract cannabis oil. He said, well, there is Epidiolex, but that's not full extract, that's CBD. He applied again for a trial for Epidiolex and it was refused. He actually phoned them and they refused it. So that was that. And I said to him, if that's refused, what about me taking him to Holland for treatment? And his words were to me, you have no choice. And I'm grateful to him forever, because if he hadn't have told me to go, I wouldn't have gone. I never wanted to do anything illegal and I never wanted to be irresponsible. You know, even though I wanted to save my son's life, I always wanted to be responsible. We'd already been to see our MP, who had supported it as well, as long as we went to a paediatric neurologist. But when I talked to him about medical cannabis, it was really funny. I will never forget it. He said, but you're just his mum, you're not a doctor. You know, because I was saying medical cannabis could work for him. He said, yeah, but you're not a doctor. And I said, yeah, but there's no doctors in this country that know about it. So actually, I know more about it. But yeah, this doctor was like, yes, absolutely, go to Holland as long as you see a paediatric neurologist. And I told him the hospital I wanted to go to, the neurologist I wanted to see. And he said, yeah. And we went to Holland on the 14th of September 2017.
Were you there for a long time?
We were there for 5 months.
You actually moved there then, effectively?
Yeah, we lived in a holiday park for 5 months, which was not fun. It wasn't a holiday by any stretch of imagination, but a holiday park was the cheapest place. I mean, The Hague, where we went, is absolutely beautiful, but it's extremely expensive, and obviously the pound's very weak. Between January 2017 and September 2017, through our Alfie's Hope Facebook page, we actually had a Just Giving site as well, and we'd raised about £20,000 to go to Holland as well. We also raised some other money from family and friends, so we had about £30,000 at our disposal, and we actually spent it all, because 5 months there, we had to, half of the money went on his medication, because we had to obviously pay for all his other medication and his cannabis oil while we were there. Yeah, he started on full extract CBD oil. We did that for 3 months and his seizures just started to stretch out. I mean, it didn't work for the first 5 weeks, which was really difficult. And I remember leaving the hospital, I literally pulled to the side of the road, I sat and I cried and I screamed and I know it sounds weird, but I just said to the universe, I said, please help me, please help me, my son will die, please help me. And I know that sounds a bit crazy, but I absolutely believe in that. I believe that sometimes when you do things like that, just something happens, and maybe it was just coincidence again, but it was a great outpouring of emotion. And within the next week, he started to really do well, and his seizures started to ebb away, and it was probably just a comforting thing for me to feel like that, you know, the universe was sort of helping me. But it just was a really sort of poignant moment that I'll never forget. And then after 3 months, we introduced a very low dose of THC. So we use a pure THC called Bedeka, and he's on 3 milligrams a day of that, and then his seizures stopped completely. Alfie was doing very well, and then we had to come home because we ran out of money. So we had to take Alfie off the oil, and it made him very ill. We're not allowed to bring the THC into the UK, so we took him off the THC. He ended up in hospital again every 10 days. What we did is if we kept him on a CBD, which did help him, and we upped that quite high, and that did help him. He still had seizures, but he wasn't in hospital as much, and that really is the only way we could fight the campaign, because by making him more stable. I mean, the way the campaign worked, actually, is that we got in contact with Molly Meacher, Baroness Molly Meacher, who's an amazing woman. She was brilliant, really, really supportive, because she's been campaigning on cannabis legislation for years before me. She put us in touch with a man called Peter Carroll, who's the director of a campaign group called End Our Pain. And he came to see us and he said, look, you know, we can help you with this campaign, because I knew I had to campaign and I knew I had to get the government to do what I wanted, but I had no idea how I was going to do that. And I needed someone who had lots of media contacts and was good with strategy, and I'm just Alfie's mum, you know, I don't... So I met him. He's an absolutely wonderful guy, and we owe so much to him. We were very lucky as well, as I say, serendipity. Our MP at the time was the Attorney General. So that was helpful. So obviously he had a lot of influence because he's senior. The lawyer of the Conservative Party. So that was wonderful. So we had a meeting with the policing minister, Nick Hurd, and all his officials, the lawyers and the head of the drugs legislation side. And we went and met with them and they said, and you'll laugh at this, they said, oh, you can have Epidiolex. And I thought, oh, that's funny. How funny that is. We can have Epidiolex now. We couldn't have Epidiolex before, but now we can have Epidiolex. You're desperate for us to have Epidiolex. So I don't think they counted on me going to Holland with my child. And I suppose then, at that point, they were like, oh, and I said, but Epidiolex isn't the same. Epidiolex is an isolated cannabinoid. It's CBD only. It's not going to work like this because I've proved that full extract cannabis works really well. I'm not going backwards. Mm. But it just makes me laugh how you can't have something. And then when you start to ruffle feathers, you can have everything. You know, I thought they were going to present it to me on a golden platter. They're desperate for me to have it. So they said, OK, well, if you're not going to accept that, then we could think about doing a trial, full extract cannabis or trial with Alfie. We went away and talked to our doctors, and our doctor said, you can't do a trial with one person who's already on the medication. You haven't got a placebo. It doesn't work. So we went back to them and we said, no, that's not going to work. You know, this is a Schedule 1 drug. We want to apply for a license as a pharmaceutical company does for research. We want our doctors to be able to do that. So they said, OK, and went away and thought about it. Also, our change.org petition was building a lot of momentum because I'd been doing some media. I'd went on BBC Breakfast. Our petition was building. NDARP then created a day for us where MPs were going to come and talk to us in London about it. So that was the end of March. And we had loads, over 150 MPs and Lords came, which is unprecedented. NDARP said, you know, that's really good. Talked to us about Alfie. We took Alfie with us, but he wasn't in a very good place because he'd just come out of a cluster, so he didn't cope very well with it, but we did take him. I haven't really took him to anything else since because I actually don't think it's appropriate. Having seen him in that space, he didn't cope with it, and I just think actually...
That's not fair.
It's not fair on him. He's a little boy. And that day also, we walked to number 10 Downing Street and gave in our petition. Drew, Alfie, Annie, my daughter and me went to the front door, knocked on the door and we were let in, which I couldn't believe because that's unheard of. You know, they give petitions
every
day.
Were they expecting you? Did they know you were coming?
I think so. We have a very, very wonderful man called Sir Mike Penning who supports us, and he is a Conservative MP, but he's extremely supportive of Alfie's campaign and a wonderful man. And I believe that he ensured that we got into the number 10. So we're very, very grateful to him for all his hard work on behalf of Alfie as well. So we went in and we met Sir Mike Penning, Nick Hurd, the policing minister, who actually I've got a great deal of respect for because he was in a very difficult position. And when I've met him since, he's, you know, been lovely to me. Maybe he's like that to everyone. Him, our MP, Jeremy Wright. And we were sat down having coffee, talking about how we might do this licence, and then the door opens and the Prime Minister walks in.
Wow.
Which we didn't think was going to happen at all. And I stood up, I can't remember what I said, I think, hello Prime Minister, because I was just absolutely like, oh, didn't know this was going to happen, I wasn't prepared. And she came over, and to be fair to her, she was actually, it was brief, because it was when the Russian thing was going on, all the problems with Russia, so they'd just come out of a cabinet meeting, and we were walking up the stairs, and I saw Boris Johnson walking out, and Amber Rudd, and it was quite crazy to be in number 10 and see all these people. So anyway, she walked in and she said, I'm very busy, but I just wanted to come and say hello and meet Alfie and everything. And she said, can you just tell me a bit more about your story? And I told her about Alfie. And she said, well, we'd like to help you within the law. She said, you can apply for a licence under compassionate grounds and we'll make it as speedy as possible. And I just was like, well, thank you very much. You know, that's what we wanted. That's what we wanted to hear. Mm. So that was great that she did that. She left. And we came outside and obviously did a few interviews to talk about what was said. So that was wonderful. We went away then. Then our doctor, our paediatric neurologist, unfortunately, he had to go on compassionate leave because he had a family bereavement. And we had another doctor who was quite on the shelf about whether Alfie should have this medicine. But, you know, there was no denying that he'd gone from having 400 seizures a month to none. That's evidence you can't sort of mess around with. So he said, OK, we'll apply for the licence and I'll prescribe. And then he was blocked, unfortunately, by his hospital trust. Even though the government had said that he could do it, the hospital trust said that Alfie still had to have Epidiolex, which, even though I presented evidence to show that Epidiolex was nothing like Bedrolite, they still wouldn't accept it. So that's something that we still have ongoing with them as a complaint, because it's absolutely ridiculous. Before our doctors went off on compassionate leave, he actually also tried to prescribe for us, because we had a meeting while we were in Holland and he was blocked as well. And he was told that if he did prescribe for us, he'd be breaching GMC rules and he'd be sacked. Actually, we know that's not true, because we had Lord O'Shaughnessy ask a question about it in the Lords. And any doctor can prescribe anything off-label, unlicensed, as a special, if they believe and they can prove with evidence that it's the right thing to do.
And you have the evidence.
And we have the evidence. Yeah.
It's not down to costs. It wouldn't be a cost thing from the hospital trust.
Not when our local hospital trust would have to pay for it, and Alfie was costing the local hospital trust nearly £200,000 a year going into hospital every week. He's now saving them £170,000 a year by not being in hospital. So, mm-hmm. No, I think it was a negligence issue. I think it was fear again. I think it was lots of stuff, but not what was in the best interest of Alfie. We then had to find a group of doctors who were willing to help us. So we went off and we were very lucky. Our GP was brilliant and said, I can see all this money we're saving, more than, you know, obviously it's great that Alfie was well, but, you know, GPs are very stretched with their budgets. And he was like, this is crazy. It has to be prescribed, you know. And then we met a wonderful man called Professor Mike Barnes through End Our Pain. He is a neurologist and a specialist in brain injury, but also the leading cannabis-based medicines expert in the country, in the UK. Professor Mike Barnes said to us, yeah, I'll help you. And when we met Nick Hurd, the police minister, he said, I don't mind who does it. We just need a doctor to do it. As I say, he was sort of desperate to help us. He was convinced by what we were saying to him. Mm-hmm. He just wanted a doctor to do it. He even said our GP could do it. You know, he just said anyone can apply for the licence. We just need a doctor. So we got together a group of doctors, Professor Mike Barnes, our GP, and also two other paediatric neurologists who weren't going to be prescribing, but they were going to provide governance, which was great. We then started the application, and we were in 4 months in, and they were still saying, you've got to do this. You know, the legislation people were still providing us with all this extra. I mean, I remember Molly Meacher saying to me, it's like you're trying to import plutonium, because it was just madness. You know, madness. But we were like, okay, we'll play the game. We just want to get this license. In the end, I had enough, basically. Our MP, again, as I said, Jeremy Wright, amazing man, the Attorney General at the time, organised a meeting in his office in Parliament with all the people from the Home Office and our doctors and us, trying to get this resolved, because I think he'd had enough of it then. By then, it's 4 months in, this is ridiculous. So this was June. He basically went through the list of problems and agreed them all, which was great. That's what we needed. They then said, OK, fine, we resolved everything. We went away, and then they phoned me up. Someone from the Home Office phoned me up and said, oh, no, there's just... And I just went, no, I'm done. I just went absolutely mental at this guy. And I've always tried to be very respectful. And it's one thing I'm really proud of, is that when people talk about our campaign, they always say that I was dignified and polite. And I like to think that the way you achieve things is by working with people. Yeah. But at that point, I just thought, I'm done. I've had enough. That was on the Monday. And the next morning, I was on the Today programme with John Humphreys just to talk about my meeting with Theresa May, which happened. She looked me in the eye and she said to me, you can have a licence application and it will be speedy and it will be compassionate. Well, it wasn't compassionate, it wasn't speedy. So anyway, I went on that radio show. It was a great interview. John Humphreys was absolutely amazing to me, because I know some people have said he can be quite frightening, but he's absolutely amazing. And he put his arms around me and he hugged me and he said, if there's anything I can do for you, I'm here. And I thought, wow, that's great, you know. I did loads of other interviews that morning, because obviously the phone just went mental, because I'd done this interview about... Because that's the other thing as well. We'd agreed with the Home Office to be media silent. So the whole 4 months, I had not done any media. Mm. Because, again, I wanted to be respectful of them. They said, if you don't badger us, we'll do the right thing. Fine. But at that point, I just thought, no, you're playing me a bit here, because I'm being quite respectful and you're not doing what you've said. So I've had enough. And then I got a phone call from Nick Hurd, and he said to me, Alfie's licence will be issued today, and we're really sorry, and you've done amazing work, and thank you very much. So, again, I was a bit frightened when he phoned me. I thought he was going to shout at me. And the
Peter from NRPA said, "You're not going to shout at you, because if he does, you'll tell the papers." And I was like, so whether a lot of it's old flannel, but I like to think that actually the stuff he said to me, he was sincere, and I've met him since, and he's been very lovely to me. So, and he did say, he said, "I'm sorry it's taken so long. It shouldn't have, but you have to understand we've never done this before, and we're worried about it." You know, and they're human beings at the end of the day, and they're working within a law, aren't they? And they weren't going to change the law at that point. So I went onto the news, and obviously I did know, but I couldn't say that I knew when I was being interviewed. So I was interviewed on ITV, and they told me, actually, because the Home Secretary announced it 15 minutes earlier than we thought. So I was actually live on air when he announced it in the Parliament, and she actually told me, and that was amazing to be live on air when that happened. But he announced that day that Alfie would have his licence. So Alfie received the first licence in the UK for medical cannabis, but also that there would be a review into the use of cannabis-based medicines. And within 2 weeks, the Chief Medical Officer, Dame Sally Davies, had done a report to say that, yes, there was evidence to say that medical cannabis could be used for various symptoms, pain from chemotherapy and MS and epilepsy and things like that. So, you know, that was really good. And then the ACMD had to do a review, and obviously other, you know, bodies were doing reviews, and it was all really, really positive. And then the Home Secretary obviously announced on the 1st of November that the law would change, and that medical cannabis would be moved to a Schedule 2, including THC, which meant that doctors can prescribe it legally without a licence under what's called a specials, because it's not licensed. Obviously, the 1st of November, I was just like, this is brilliant. You know, we've gone from a position where we were trying to save my son's life to a position where we could save many lives and give people, families, better lives. You know, that's my passion. And I know I probably shouldn't focus completely on childhood epilepsy, but I know what it's like to be the mother of a very severe epileptic.
Yes,
I
really
don't know what
experience.
It's like to have MS. I don't know what it's like to have Parkinson's. So, you know, whilst everyone should have it who needs it, that's my focus. And at that time, I'd been asked to be, and I'm now an ambassador for NDARPA in the campaign group. So I've been working a lot with families, supporting them, helping them to lobby their MPs, helping them to talk to their doctors. So the law was changed on the 1st of November. But unfortunately, Peter said to me, actually, which is a great analogy, he said the Home Office had a crystal vase, and the Home Secretary showed great leadership and was very good at this. And I thought, you know, he really dealt with it very well. He saw a need and he dealt with it. You know, that was it. It was like he passed a crystal vase to the Department of Health and they smashed it on the floor, because literally the guidelines that they've issued are so restrictive that there's no doctor at the moment that we know of in this country that feels happy to prescribe. So we've gone to a point where we've had this great elation, we've changed the law, and families are so excited. You know, there's some families out there, their children have tried 10, 15 different drugs, had brain surgery, still having seizures every day. Great hope, great joy, this is amazing. Stopped, all stopped, because the guidelines basically say that this has to be a medicine of last resort. So there's over 20 antiepileptics. Are you saying that a child of 3 years old has to try 20 antiepileptics?
Which would take a long, long time.
Take years. Are you saying that they need brain surgery before, you know, it's medical cannabis, as I said, has such low side effect profile that this is just, I'm not saying it should be the first drug, but it could be the third. It doesn't have to be the
final.
End. It doesn't have to be the end. So that's very frustrating, but also there's not enough assurances that people are safe. So we've had one family that doctor did actually prescribe and then they withdrew it because they felt really worried about doing it, because they were worried the GMC would, you know, have them hauled up and they'd get sacked. That's why I'm carrying on campaigning as I am for End Our Pain and for all the families I work with. And we've got a petition as well, which now has nearly 500,000 signatures, that talks about the way families are affected and the fact that we want the NHS just to relax the guidance a little bit and give doctors the confidence to prescribe. Because I do know there's lots of doctors in this country that want to prescribe, but they're frightened. Mm-hmm. My little boy is safe, he has his prescription, he will never be without his medicine, but there's a lot of work to be done still.
I have to say, the interview ran for over an hour and she was absolutely fascinating from start to finish. And I've had to lose so much of this. So we're going to put the full interview onto our website. And I think that's something to say, because if you are interested in this topic and you're interested in hearing more from Hannah, I had to lose so much good stuff that it was soul destroying. So I really, really urge people to look at our website, womenmakingwaves.co.uk, and look at the full interview.
That's all we have time for in this edition of Women Making Waves.
We'd like to thank our guests, Hannah Deacon and Sheila Cassane Marshall. If you know of a woman who is making waves, we'd like to speak to her.
You can contact us via social media on Twitter and Facebook at WomenMW or on Instagram at Women Making Waves Radio. You can also visit our website, womenmakingwaves.co.uk, where you can hear all of our interviews.
Women Making Waves is a Jibber Jabber production.